going to have Catherine Stanway, who is with our Division of Forestry and Wildlife. She's our legal fellow coming in and helping us out, seeing if there's any questions for you folks. This is a really interesting and potentially complicated agenda item. Basically, we have a situation where it's very difficult for us to enforce natural air reserve rule violations. We have been looking at different options for penalizing folks by setting up a fee schedule for different infractions. So the task that we have been put before ourselves and you is to assign what types of fees are a good deterrent and a good, measure against the actual crime that's committed. So we have categorized our different prohibitions kind of by severity and are asking for your thoughts on what whether you think that these fee schedules are adequate. And I think it's very difficult for all of us to do this in a way because there's always a very wide range within a violation. You could have someone littering a cup out the window, or you could have them dumping, you know, a mattress down a gulch or something. You know, there's, and so saying, you know, a $500 violation for littering, you know, is adequate and appropriate is always very something that's difficult for us because there is this wide range. And so just keep that in mind. You know, we are going through this and kind of thinking about what's the worst possible case scenario versus the, you know, the most common possible violations and just trying to hone in on what we think is something that's adequate. So I guess I'll stop before we start like going down the actual violations and getting your feedback. I do want to just make sure that you folks have some background on what the civil violation resource schedule is and see if you have any questions. So this is going to go to the Board of Land and Natural Resources. The Division of Aquatic Resources has actually done a similar thing. We're basically copying them and establish their fee schedule, and our fees are kind of in the relative range as their fees for when you, you know, catch too many fish or you catch a species out of season and all these sorts of things. So, you know, it's not like their fees are in the thousands while ours are in the tens or something. It's, we're trying to kind of be in the same range. And other divisions within or other sections within DOFAR are also going to do this. So we're doing this for the forest reserves. We're doing it for Nalahele rule violations, wildlife sanctuaries. So while we're going to get your feedback on the NARs, we're also going to probably take into account what other sections within DOFAR are doing too and try to calibrate so that a violation of basically the same thing in one isn't like many times as much as another designation. We want to have some sort of standardization. So what you recommend to us is just going to kind of go into that that thought process and go to the board. So it might be tinkered with is another way of what I'm saying. So but we really hope to get your thoughts on these penalties and, you know, just have another set of eyes kind of give feedback on whether things seem too easy or too hard on these different violations. So that's basically what we'll go through. Unfortunately, we don't have a huge amount of time for the, well, we have probably an hour and a half that we could put forward for this, so anyway, we do have to move quickly through them too, so just keep that in mind. And Catherine's here if you have any other questions that are more techie about what the yes. Go ahead.
So do these Are they interchangeable? Like, can we use the statutes that are for forest reserves for natural area reserves, or they're just specific to, like, on the spreadsheet I see, on the middle, there's certain rules for forest reserves. Are those, can we use those in the NARs as well?
If a forest reserve is also a NAR, then you can, but if it's not overlapping, then no.
You know, what we're going to be looking at is just the NARS tab, and so that's the one that has the actual fees drafted, but there are all these other violations that are listed in the other tabs too.
Like, just for instance, this harvested koa, like, that's definitely an issue on Kauai, so is that something that we can have on the NARS list as well?
It would have to be a rule in the NARS. So definitely any removal of biotic resources is a violation in the NARS already. So we don't need to take it from the forest reserves.
So it would just be considered plants. It wouldn't be like...
Yeah.
Okay.
Does the fine sort of cover staff time to try to figure it, you know, to bring a action against somebody?
No. Yeah, I don't believe so.
Because sometimes they get pretty entangled and you spend a lot of time.
That's for sure.
And you're only getting $20 for $1,000 time.
I think that that's a separate administrative process for violations. And so in those instances, we can charge administrative costs too. But I believe the CRBS actually, it's just the set amount. And I guess the thought is for the administrative civil penalties, you do have a much higher standard of being able to prove guiltiness for the violations, and also there's a lot of opportunity for the person to appeal so they can do a contested case, and it's just a lot messier, and so it's usually for the bigger violations, whereas this is like, okay, you've done something bad, and we're going to deal with it through a comparatively smaller fee. Because a lot of those aren't really being addressed right now.
Just as kind of answering his question a little bit, the Division of Aquatic Resources, when we have like some of the major coral damage stuff when ships go aground, we tally in all the costs, all costs, including live coral, whatever you, and they're all itemized.
Okay.
And then if it goes into a contested case, you know, they argue these points, and sometimes it's X amount, and people just pay the fine, or they'll try to, you know, negotiate the thing down.
Yeah.
But everything I've seen so far on the marine resource side has shown a itemization of the amount of damage, the value of the damage in dollars, and the cost of recovery or remediation. And that's not a bad way to go for DOFA also, because some of this, some of the costs of remediation can be pretty
huge.
Heavy.
Yeah, I don't know. I wasn't here when Emma first started talking about this, so I apologize if she already said this, but there are three types of penalties, I guess, that could be assessed for like a statute or rule violation for DLNR. And so this is just one of the systems. So there's criminal that go to the court. There's board action, which is what Bob's talking about. And then there's this civil resource violation system, which is more like a traffic ticket. So it's like a quick way to... It's kind of usually for more like minor violations, but not necessarily.
So, sorry, getting to that column...
Yes.
Those, which ones are those? Is that the...
This is all CRBS. Like, this is all the rules. So we wanted DOFA to consider which ones should be put into CRBS. So, like, the board has to approve a sanction schedule for every rule that would be available to have this penalty.
So, basically, the statute, however, says what the max is.
Right.
So,
and,
if you...
And that's
instance,
the ones that you're having trouble collecting from people.
Yeah, we definitely are. So, for instance, if you have more than 10 people in an R and you get busted for it, because that's one of the violations, you can't be charged more than 2,500. So, off the bat, don't suggest that we charge anyone more than the max fine.
Typically, they wouldn't be charged the max fine on a first offense, I would imagine.
Well, 2,500 is the max, and
for the first offense.
For the first offense.
Is there a minimum?
No,
$100.
No minimum.
No, $100, isn't it?
No. What we have in columns G, H, and I are the proposed fines.
Okay.
That are going to just be kind of like the standard go-to fines for each violation. So, for instance, we consider hiking in an R with more than 10 people the least serious of all NAR rules violations. So that's why we have a 50, 100, 200 schedule for that. And then at the bottom, we have more and more serious violations. So, anyway, that's kind of how we're categorizing these things.
And is there wording in that statute that excludes NARs that have trails on them?
No, it's anywhere. I mean, you could show up in our parking lot, for example, with 10 people in your van, and you'd be in violation. It's just being present. It's not the hiking part of it.
Well, it's a
group size.
So the thought is not like, because obviously we have NARs where there's hundreds of people on them, but, and this is one reason this is a kind of difficult violation for us, which is what is the definition of group, you know? What if it's your friend, but you didn't come here on your own? So that's, again...
Separate cars.
Yeah, separate cars, you know, whatever. So just putting it out there, this is a very strange one, to be honest.
I think it really backs up commercial activity, because you can't always prove commercial activity, but if there's one guy and 13 people behind him, it's like, okay,
yeah,
you're too big of a group. It also protects the wilderness qualities of the natural area reserves. You know, you don't want to show up to a place by yourself and then 13 people walk up on you like a ruckus, right? So it's kind of to keep group sizes small in natural area reserves.
Can you get a permit to bring a group?
Yeah.
So should all of these things such as that say without a permit?
I think that's kind of implied.
Yeah, it's implied.
So anything you're going to do in the natural area reserve that's illegal, like it's all in the permit application, and you just check off the boxes. So when you fill out a permit, I'm gonna bring my school group of 25 people, and we want to go in a closed area. You're gonna check off. You're gonna break the group size rule and the closed area rule, and that goes into your permit application.
Right. The rules have a section saying prohibition or prohibited actions, and it says unless permitted. So you can basically do anything if you get permitted to do it.
And I don't know if Emma prefaced this as well as I understand it, because this is really applicable to like an area where I work, where you have a lot of public access, and you have all these different things going on, and you've only got two officers around, and they can't get down there in time to do these kinds of things. So the threshold for, proving doubt or whatever that they did this is much lower, so that... You know, I mean, we can actually get some traction with some of these things, like, you know, your dog and, all the smaller things that you see people doing all the time that you can't, that it's not worth a doe care officer's time to come down and try to enforce, right? Like, that they're going to show up if I've got divers in the water, but they're not going to come when I've got the surfers tying their dogs to trees and things like that, right? So the CRBS is this kind of, I guess, lesser fine system that's more usable for staff and managers to get compliance in our areas where they're just overrun, I think. Because you're, you know, I mean, you're not going to run into this in the middle of Ponte V because you're not going to see anybody, right? But in Ahihi, where we get 300,000 guys a year, right? And, you know, we've got guys, like, spying on us, waiting for us to leave to do bad things. You know, it's like this type of thing will really curb the illegal activity, in our opinion.
And the idea is that you and your staff basically write, like, a ticket, like a parking ticket?
I'm not sure if we're going to go that direction, but that would be the ultimate end result, is, like, that, yeah, I can, you know, give you a Manini fire, littering, those types of things that aren't, you know what I mean, like, I'm not catching you in the red hand with a net in your hand and you're going to beat me up, kind of thing like that, right?
But the concept is that because these numbers are so much, these fines are so much lower than the statute, that people are likely to pay them and not ask for a court date.
Right. Yeah, because the court is really hard. I mean, the tow care officers tell us that on the ground all the time.
Right.
For example, I did catch some guys diving a couple weeks ago. Tow care made it down just as they exited our boundary, right? And so, you know, they couldn't really do anything to these guys and whatnot. And then, you know what I mean, it's on me to now, I have to make a witness statement, have to show up in court. Me and the guy got to go head to head, him saying like, oh, you know, well, my friend swam in there, so I swam in after him, and then we exited, and, you know, all these kinds of things. And I'm like, no, you know, I saw you guys pop your head up and look at me and kind of like just keep going, you know. We don't have to go through all that because it's not a criminal threshold that we're trying to, you know what I mean, break here and get them convicted. It's like, yeah, take your fine, you know, I saw you, that's good enough.
Right. And this is not something that goes on a record.
Right. So, I mean, us guys on Maui, we're like, yeah, come on, when is this going to go through? The first day we sat down and talked to it, this is like a really, to me, it's got to be one of the most useful tools to come down the pipe for the area where I work.
And obviously, like with any similar violation, people would have the option to contest it if they wanted to take the time and say, no, I wasn't doing this or whichever. And then it goes down that route. But otherwise, it's a small enough fine that people are more likely to just pay it than to do that. I mean, is that part of the logic of setting the amount?
Yeah, let me just clarify two things, too, before. So right now, like, our attorneys are advising us that the tow care officers issue the tickets because they're, like, the enforcement officers of the department, sorry. So right now, that's how we're looking at doing this. And then the other thing is this doesn't go to court. So like you said, it doesn't go on a record. There's an administrative hearings officer here in DLNR. So he, like, OCCL does this right now in DAR. I don't think they've implemented it yet, but, like, they'll issue a notice of violation to somebody, issue a ticket, I guess, in this case, like, and they just pay it. Or they contest it to the hearings officer, and they hear them, and then they can appeal it. They can appeal it to the board. They can appeal it all the way up to the Supreme Court at some point if they want to. But yeah, the appeal process.
So I think the most productive way that we can have this discussion would be to I'll just kind of list things in the different chunks. Rather than go rule for rule in the beginning, so you kind of get a sense for the different magnitudes. And so just in the first chunk here, we have the 100 first offense category. And so that would be entering into a cave, using narcotics or drugs or alcohol, not paying your parking fees in a Ahihi Canal, placing a vessel in a lake or a pond, or entering into a lake or a pond, or disturbing a lake or a pond, and then not bringing your permit when you have a special use permit. So that's kind of one chunk, Just keep that in mind. Okay, the next category would be having fishing gear in a heat canal, damaging geological or paleontological features, camping, making a temporary residence, littering, or depositing any substance, anchoring in a heat canal, and that's that category. And then the $500 category is operating a motorized vehicle in a freshwater environment, except as otherwise provided in the boating rules. So freshwater, this is mostly like Lake Waiau would be the main, if you had a motorized vehicle. And removing, injuring, or killing any plant or animal life, except as, if you're using, if you're a hunter. And then operating a motorized or unmotorized land or air vehicle in a trail or road that not designated for its use. Commercial activities, presence in a closed section or after visiting hours, introducing any form of plant or animal life, removing any notice, marker, or structure, or damaging, a sign, basically, to engage in any construction, start or maintain a fire, and this is a kind of weird one, but to disturb vegetation and wildlife more than you absolutely have to if you're a permit holder. So we do offer permits to folks to, in some cases, disturb vegetation or wildlife, but this is basically if you do it excessively. Okay. Then we have two more. This is the $1,000 category. There's only one in this category, which is disturb, remove, damage historic or prehistoric remains. And then the most serious, which is the $2,500 category, is being a permit holder and not making sure that your gear is clean. And the thought is that the main way that you would be caught doing this is if you actually ended up introducing any invasive species that then naturalized, so that would cause a large amount of damage to the reserve. Yes.
Why would that be more than adding than bringing something deliberately? Why is the, I guess, what's the logic? Because in that $500 mm-hmm. category, there was deliberately yeah. introduced something. In this case, this is introducing something, mm-hmm. maybe negligently, but I'm just wondering why the difference between those two.
The thought was, and this is, again, just a group yeah. of all of us just kind of throwing ideas out there in mm-hmm. Kind of a quick rundown of these different things. So, again, we're really not married to this at all. We're very happy to get your thoughts on it. It's great that you guys are asking these questions. The thought at the time was that the one that's permitted and not intentional, the main idea is that that would lead. Now, I'm thinking about this, and it doesn't quite make sense, so I'll just put that out there. But that would lead to, that would be noticed if the person does introduce a invasive species that then spreads and is really damaging. The thought with the other one was that it could be something like someone bringing in a dog or something like that that might be kind of more intentional, but in other ways of looking at it, definitely there's, yeah, so.
There's just permit and non-permit.
Yeah.
Non-permit holders. It might mm-hmm. make more sense.
How would you know that someone brought something in? It takes a while for a seed to germinate. I mean, how, you could say, well, it wasn't me, it was the guy that came after me. I don't know how you would prove that.
I think that that's the problem with that we all face, that some of these things aren't very easily proven, mm-hmm. but I think for instance, a permittee, we actually, that's the only way that we know if someone's actually at an area. So let's say we permit someone to go and study forest birds at Honeybee Natural Area Reserve. And then we realize all of a sudden where they've been camping has an infestation of fire ants.
Okay.
That would be one of the only ways we could really, like, know.
But it's only in special places. It's not like, it's not like another NARS like Hikinau. It'd be because everybody and his brother goes there, and you would never be able to prove that. But
that one, we can get them for dogs. We use the same rule to introduce for a dog. So a dog on a leash is introducing an animal the same as you leaving your weeds behind in the... But I would add to the permittees, contractors is another one. So we have a lot of control, I think, over permittees, but then not so much over contractors. I mean, you can write that kind of stuff into their contracts, but I don't think sometimes they don't have, you know what I mean? Your permittees are usually researchers and conservationists. Your contractors are generally like a rougher breed, so maybe not as in tune to what they may or may not be carrying on their gear and things like that. So I would add that to that, too. So if you've got a fence line, you know, that you've got a contractor working on, and then you come back and the fence line has, like, obvious populations of this weed that they've been tracking down the line, then I think that would be another one. And then, again, with it being CRVS, you've got the lower threshold than calling them criminals in a court.
And just to be clear, that the wording of the offenses, I mean, that's coming right out of NARS rules. Those, we can't adjust those. We're strictly talking about the...
We can, in the future, change our NARS
in the future, yeah. But
right
for this
now,
exercise, we're just specific. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I'm hearing your point about having some sort of standardization. Like, if it's going to be super, huge penalty for bringing in, if you're a permit holder, we should have that standardized with folks bringing it in just incidentally that are not permit holders.
Yeah, I could just imagine situations where a permit holder gets busted for doing the same thing that a non-permit holder did and pays a much bigger fine.
But then the issue with the dogs, I mean, if that same rule, if he's using that rule with a dog, that doesn't make sense. Should it be fined $2,500 for...
No, but the dog person wouldn't have a permit to, excuse me, bring in dog. Well...
Yeah, not normally. The hunters are allowed hunting dogs. But yeah, the permit, or yeah, just your general public, we use that rule to keep them from bringing
dogs.
So
are you suggesting we reduce the amount of the permitted person's activity, or we equalize this, or what?
I'm not sure that it rises to the level of being that high, considering that we have something comparable that is at a much lower level.
Except that in many cases, the permit holders are going to places that are more pristine,
right,
that regular folks aren't going to go into, and so the damage to the environment ends up being much more serious. And they should know better.
They should know better, right.
And they will have signed some sort of form saying, I will or will not do X, Y, and Z.
Mm-hmm.
So I can kind of see why it might be higher. Because one,
right,
remediating the damage is going to cost a lot more, because you got to fly in and to some remote place and get rid of the fire ants.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if we can assume that, though, because there's... You get permits for areas areas that are very accessible too. It's, I don't think that that's necessarily a distinction, because all of these remote areas are open too, so the public can go to these places.
What about TNC and your Waikumoi, and you have contractors coming in, and are you the permit holder, or are they the permit holder for those?
There's just waivers. I mean, there's no permit per se, since it's private land. It's just,
okay.
Yeah.
It's not an R.
It's not an R.
Okay. Right.
Yeah, that's right.
Another scenario that came to mind is if you get these places where you're neighboring a livestock operation or a cattle ranch, and their cows bust into your natural area, that would be another introduction, right, where it would be a pretty good, your fine should be pretty hefty. Your cost to remove those types of things are, I support leaving that one pretty high, because just think about it, anything other than just something benign like a dog or maybe an escaped farm animal that got back in, anything else is like a full-on infestation that you've got to manage and monitor over a long period of time, so the cost of the department is huge.
It could be a non-permit holder doing that.
Right. And, well, the point there though is that the non-permit holder, that wouldn't be a very high. Or it's a considerably lower than if you are a permit holder. But I take your point.
Yeah, because on the NARS permit, you already signed it.
you should know better.
You're not going to introduce anything. It says in the NARS permit that you're liable for any weed introductions and all this kind of stuff.
If there were something really serious, even one of these light yellow things, could DoCare decide to charge them a high fine and not just go with the low if they wanted to? If it was an easy case to prove.
And they could even take them criminal.
Yeah. Right, that's what I mean. So this doesn't preclude the more serious charging of a crime if it really is serious and there's a good case.
Yeah,
correct?
This is like a tool to be used in the gray area, or you didn't have enough evidence to go criminal, and you're like building a small case kind of thing, right? Like, we got guys that are repeats, but you can't get the cops on them.
Would it be helpful if you guys got a printout of these and could look at them on...
You sent us a spreadsheet, right?
Yeah, but if it's too small for you to see the text.
That would be good.
Yeah, okay.
I would just say that I would hope that as much as possible... The similar, quote-unquote, the similar violations in different types of state land seems like they should be as similar as possible, just for the public's point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And I realize that
public knowledge.
You know, cutting down a tree in a NAR is, or an endangered tree in a NAR is more serious than cutting down a common tree in a forest reserve. Maybe it shouldn't be the same, but... Wherever possible, it seems like they should be similar.
Yeah. The other thing that's, I mean, again, it's worded the way it is, and for things that are a basic violation, this makes sense. But I could imagine a number of these where the degree of violation would be so grave that obviously some other consequences would have to take place, right? So obviously, going with 10 people, fine, but what happens when you go with a group of 200? Is that, where removal, let's say removal of any plant life. It's one thing to take a leaf. It's another thing to go and take all of the last seeds of some plant. So I'm just thinking about, I want to be clear that this is for basic violations and that other things are definitely covered by other statutes or other rules.
And that's a really good point. So this could be looked at as kind of the minimum fines that you think should be. But also know that so many of our violations are not really easily prosecuted. We don't have enough evidence. The burden of proof is too high. So. In practice, this is probably going to be what 99% of our cases are going to go, because even if it is really serious, we might not be able to go the criminal or civil pathway.
Yeah. Well, I'm thinking for the more serious ones, it may, I mean, in those cases, you probably would have evidence. You know, I mean, obviously,
maybe,
if you're going down and, you know, cutting down endangered trees and, you know, they catch you and your truck is full of endangered trees,
right.
You know.
She already said that these don't preclude
right.
going
yeah.
criminal.
Exactly, exactly,
exactly.
And that's just what I wanted. I wanted to clarify.
So what are the ramifications if you cut down an ancient tree and your truck pulls, like, it, how do people get prosecuted in that way?
It would be an endangered species law.
Yeah. Say it was sandalwood. Say it was something that was not endangered.
Well, you know, a rare resource might be evaluated for whatever value it has, mm-hmm. and sandalwood would be a good example of that.
Yeah. So we have a violation list in that rules that says any removal or damaging of any plant or animal life.
It says alive.
And then, Emma, weren't you
really?
Telling us?
Hmm. That's interesting.
What's it say?
Well, Michelle's making the point that the rule might say any...
Oh, well, it says remove, injure, or kill any form of plant or animal life. So, I guess, maybe...
You removed it, but you didn't kill it. That's still...
Yeah, so, but if you remove, like, a dead log, is that...
That's a really good question.
Well, we tell people they can't take shells and eat.
Yeah.
Can't take shells, can't take rocks.
Can't take stones, right?
Yeah.
Well, that's, like, the rocks are geological, but,
But remove is pretty, I think remove is pretty clear.
Yeah.
It's going to take anything out.
No, but
yeah.
The point is, like, is it alive?
If it's dead, then it seems like there's, like, a little wiggle room in there. If it's a dead log.
Well, it says remove, injure, or kill, right?
Yeah, it's the or.
Yeah.
So
yes.
You didn't kill it, but it's
I think
it's or.
I think it's clear
it.
Enough. You removed it, and that's one of the things you're not supposed to do.
Yeah.
Well, say I applied for a permit to study the geology of wherever, and I want to take out 50 samples, and I take out 51. Is that that would be a violation? But even though the 51st sample was the one that was most important because there was an inclusion of something that I saw and it was great and I just had to have it, did I have to leave it there, come in, and reapply, and then come back and pick up the 51st? Okay.
That was or you're paying $1,000.
No, that was one of her rules, that if you went beyond what your permit stated or did more damage, then indeed that would be
that wouldn't be excessive, though, the excessive damage one. Was there a different rule than that?
I think that would fall under the removing a geological feature that you haven't been permitted to remove.
But, you know, when you go out and look at an area, you're not sure what you're going to sample.
Well, then, then the dominant strategy for permittees is to say you're going to remove a lot, so you get permitted to remove a lot.
Okay.
And
not to let you.
It's also, to be clear, I mean, a DoCare officer could, depending on what the action was, actually issue multiple citations for multiple counts for something that was kind of part of the same general action. Right? So you might violate your permit in the process having done grave damage, and you'd get cited for both.
And you were drinking, so...
And you were drinking while you were drunk.
Yeah, they took those everything. Each one is a fence, so, like, commercial activity, they take it to an operator for each person.
Just
right.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There you go. They add up pretty fast.
One of these?
Oh, yeah. Thanks.
Yeah.
Is there another?
Yeah.
Oh.
There's one.
Oh.
I got
it. Oh. Okay, thank you.
For
do you have
year,
one?
Yes,
oh,
the hearing officer can actually...
One more over here.
If it's like a lesser,
I assume people with laptops.
If DOFA goes to, like they hear about somebody being issued a ticket and they're like, oh, that wasn't as bad as charging them $100. Like they get the 51st sample and it really wasn't that much harm. It should be $100. Like the hearing officer can reduce that to whatever DOFA wants, so like $50 or like $100, which is more of that, right?
And isn't it true they don't have to go with the lowest one every time? Aren't those tiered recommendations? Actually, if they want to, they can write the full amount?
Yeah, they can either go with the recommended or go lower, depending on what they're from. But I'm not sure if we can go higher yet.
No, like if you have 100 in the first category, story, but like the
that's
situation
true.
Was so great. Can't they go ahead and hit him for the $2,500?
That's the second offense.
I'm not sure about that. I know you can go lower.
Yeah. Like this one, I thought that that's what they were saying is like that you know, these were our recommended, but then actually if the officer wanted to, he could go up as much as that first number.
That's what the statute says, but I don't know if we can.
The
CRBS system.
Emma was saying that it doesn't preclude that.
But it would be not just the CRBS, it would be actually charging them with a violation and
it wouldn't just be a fine.
Potentially having to go to court.
Probably like a board action or something.
Yeah, you can't just write the ticket higher than that
number.
Yeah, it's really hard. Enforcement is really hard. I mean, you come up with any example, like the girl was talking about, you catch a guy with a bunch of trees in his car, right? You get a picture of that car and everything. Doe-care goes to their house, cites them. They didn't see any logs. The guy can go in court and say, that isn't an endangered tree. And unless there's some expert sitting there on the other side saying, yeah, I can, from this picture, identify that log in the back of the truck as this endangered species, and the judge believes it, they're just going to throw it out. You can say anything in court, and then, you know, the typical thing that happens in court that when we've actually followed violations is that they just get off the first time with a warning, right? It's just like anything else. Your first time is get off scot-free. So this gives us the ability to kind of bypass that because we know what that ends like, and just like say, here's a fine, you know, take that, go on to the next.
Do you, based on the people that you have encountered violating these rules, how likely do you think it is that they will pay these $50, $100 fines, would you guess?
I think it's probably pretty likely. I mean, I think it's more likely and a lot better. I think it's more likely than them going to court and paying it.
Right. I mean, because you're the only one probably in this room who's looked these folks in the eye and charged them, you know, and
yeah,
you were guilty of X, Y, Z.
Because my tool is only the phone, right? And then the officer, currently, his only tool is these criminal penalties, you know? The other option that they talked about, the board action, that would take me months, years maybe in some instances to create a case that I can bring to the board, right, with several instances of this. Whereas, you know, with this system, I can call the officer, say, hey, I saw this guy do this, I have a picture. He can just show up and hand the ticket and he can be on his way, right? And then that guy's got to deal with that. And then maybe he gets out of that one, he doesn't pay it, he forgets about it, whatever, but these guys, they repeat, right? And eventually it's gonna catch up to them. But it's a way better scenario than just like, you know, letting them off with a warning or because, you know, you didn't have enough evidence. Because like I said, with the divers, that's what happened to me last time. They're like, you know, I'll do, the officer always comes to us and says, what do you want to do? You know, and if it's like, he tells me, you know, I think you got a great amount of evidence, I'll take that, and they'll just write the ticket. Sometimes he's asking me, you know, I don't really know if this is going to stick in court. Do you want to write a witness statement? If you'll write the witness statement and show up, then I'll still go and cite. The other option is, do you want me to just scare them or educate them? Right? And sometimes, and you know, then I got to make the call, right? And I'm like, man, but something like this just adds another tool to their war chest. And, you know, I think eventually it adds up.
I agree. I just was trying to get a sense that if based on your experience with these violators, if you had told me, or told us, sorry, that I think they're just going to ignore them anyway, then we're kind of wasting our time. But if you think this is much based on your interactions with people that you've caught doing these things, if your sense is that they typically feel guilty and they're more likely to pay the $50 or $100, then I think this is the right track.
Is this like a parking ticket?
A parking ticket.
Right, but sometimes people ignore parking tickets, too.
Well, particularly if you live out of state. And
right.
Yeah, you
right.
may be more inclined. But
you do have
what happens if they just
they do have your address.
So you
they do have.
You know?
We're still working on that.
Okay, yeah. I mean, eventually it would have to catch up to you. It's just like any other type of civil thing. I mean, you can not show up if your neighbor sues you, and it's going to come to you eventually. So I think just the officers having another tool and the ability to issue a fine with a lower threshold is what we're really after. And I think that in itself is a really good deterrent.
I think one thing that this does, too, is that where we lose very often is that if it goes into the court system, you have a prosecutor. And if the prosecutor doesn't think it's worth his or her time to pursue it, they just let it go right there. This is another avenue to address some violation that avoids having the second judgment being made by a prosecutor. And very often that's where these things end. The prosecutor just goes, I don't want to do this.
And if it is a repeat guy, this is another form of documentation, right? So the officer comes out and cites the same guy. Every time their name goes into the database, and like eventually they can say, you know, even if they can't get him criminal, well, you can just hand me the whole pile and I can go to the board with something else, right, other than just the fresh.
If somebody has been fined in a case and they have a fine and they repeat that and it's documented, that can be added. So it's like $10,000 a day per fine, per incident, per violation, per day. But we have to document that. Which in a couple of cases right now, where the person is sort of abusive and arrogant about it, we are documenting. And when it piles up, they're going to be stunned.
Yeah. A ton of bricks.
I think what would be most productive with our time is actually to get your feedback on basically first impressions. Are some of these too high? Are some of them too low? You know, compare them. Are they inconsistent? Actually, let us know whether you think that some of these should actually have different dollar amounts.
I've got a couple stood out to me, like the commercial activities one down in the $500 range. I'm just wondering, like, you know, if there's a group and the guide is charging, you know, $300-$400 a pop, even just $200, it could still be worth their, they could still make a profit and pay the time and pay the fine. So maybe that one could be higher. It's my kind of gut.
Particularly if they're not getting caught every single time they do it. If they get caught every 10th time, that's just a minor bit out of their profit margin.
We have had contested case in this very, very room where the person just writes a check for the fine for $2,500.
Right.
You know?
Goes out with a smile.
I'll make that tomorrow. Easy.
Yeah.
The other thing I would say is, you know, this is in the realm of should know better. If you're a commercial operator and you have, you know, obviously, you know, a business license and things like that, you should have some sense of what the rules are, where you're going. Mm-hmm. That just seems like a pretty standard thing. So if it is
could be sort of a different scale for commercial operators on all of these things. Possibly it's not just that one.
It should be significant because almost everybody who, by the time they come and face a contested case or fine, it's not like it's the first time. I mean, these are not innocent little schoolboys or girls.
Well, do you folks have any suggestions on an alternate minimum fine then for a commercial violation than $500?
Per incident.
Because again, this isn't like the first one is 500, then it goes, if you get caught again, it's 1,000. So if you're kind of thinking, oh, this repeat person, it is going to start getting more.
And then does it stay at 2,000? Third and like if there's a fourth offense?
I think it should be at least 2,000 for the first offense.
Yeah, it just seems like you want to nip that in the bud.
Put it down with down at the
2,500
with the 2,500.
Yeah.
Or it could be whatever after you hit the max here. You could indicate per incident per day.
I think the late payment fine is a little too low, too.
You know, oh, yeah.
You know, $10,000 and I miss the payment, so okay, I'll pay $10,025 at some point. You know, I should make that a lot higher.
Our fines with natural resources have really been easy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The amount of work our people put to maintain the resource is disgraceful what some of the fines are.
Yeah, think about a cell phone is like $100 and something already, or a seatbelt.
Can I hit them up with community service?
We would love to.
Versus you dropped anchor, right? I think a lot of them should be high, but I think that's...
Yeah, so Emma, when you folks put together, when you put these in these various categories, was part of your thinking the actual damage that...
Yeah, that was entirely our thinking, was the damage.
The damage, and how much it would cost to remediate that damage. So that's,
if possible, sometimes you can't remediate something.
Yeah, I mean, I know we've talked about this before, just among us, but I think that the one that talks about markers, construction, or fire, 500 is really too little. If you have some structure damage, I am sure we can't remediate it for $500. Mm-hmm. And a fire could be catastrophic.
But could some of those get bumped over to the...
He goes into
a
criminal court.
That's the thing. It's like, okay, let's say someone is just like making a fire and it hasn't made this catastrophic, but it, like someone's camping or something.
Mm-hmm.
I guess in these instances, we're kind of thinking about the smallest, most manini of the violations rather than if they have burned down the whole mountain, then we would probably want to go different route.
I'm not going to just write them a ticket.
That's true.
So anyway, it's something we're constantly going back and forth on of, like, there's so many different gradations of what could happen in these different violations, but...
Whereas commercial activity, I can't see some very small or accidental, it's hard to imagine something like that. Especially since it sets a precedent.
It's hard to deny intent.
Yeah.
Well, I could easily see that. I mean, people decide, I'm going to make an ecotourism company. And you go down and you get a business license, and you might be fresh off the boat. You have no clue that you're not supposed to do that in an hour. I mean, I'll bet people do that all the time.
My area, they got no labels on the van. Everybody's
they're all
coached to say we're friends. There's no, like,
came on the phone.
Yeah.
So even the groups larger than 10, I mean, geez, that doesn't even come close to even covering any of the administrative costs that is just paper around. So, I mean, I think we should increase that more.
You notice the number of people that have been taking their ads off the internet when the county cracked down on vacation rentals and stuff. That's a big, hefty fine.
Yeah.
But again, the balance is, if you make it too high, then people contest them and you don't get anything. So I agree with you that it's a serious thing, but if you make them too angry, then we're back where we started from.
And that place is very bad. I'm just letting you know. Like, the contesting pathway is decades sometimes of our time, just doing, you know, huge amounts of legal work, huge amounts of... And it's very easy for the person that's the defendant to keep the process going. Like, all they have to do is just say, I contest this. Whereas we have to do a huge amount of work with every step that they appeal.
Right.
So that's where we really want to have this balance.
Right. That's how come I asked. For the people that you have cited, is your impression that they would just go ahead and pay this? And you said yes. So
I think so. I think that you'll... Because, like I said, I think that the vast majority of people aren't getting even a citation because we didn't have enough evidence, right? So then, you know, you give them a reasonable citation
they'll pay it to not have to deal and forget about it, right? But yeah, then you get the guys that are more repeat, and then eventually I can use all those citations to make a criminal case or a board case. So I think they'll pay it.
I guess from that rationale, then we keep the prices low.
That's kind
so
of what
we can
I
keep
was,
on just right. issuing the tickets and identifying where the
And if it's the same person gets
yeah.
cited a fourth or fifth time, then maybe you try and nab them
yeah.
and go for the full-on thing. But
well, right there, it seems like they're already admitting a fourth or fifth, you know, four guilt by just paying off the ticket, right? And you have record of that. So that helps you make a board case or a criminal case in the future, I think.
Yeah, I don't know.
I think commercial could still be higher.
Yeah, well, just because that's a case where somebody's actually getting something out of it.
Yeah.
Right? It's one thing when you litter, you're not getting anything out of it, really, right? And so it's like, okay, now you're going to pay for doing that litter. But in the case of commercial activity, it's not incidental. I mean, I think it's also something that, you know, is likely to be delivered or at least something where somebody should know better. Mm-hmm. And again, it's... I think that's a special case where because there is pressure to do that in certain places, you want something that is preventative. You want something that is going to dissuade people from wanting to do it.
A question on one that may swing the other way. So below commercial is to be present in an area closed or after visiting hours. Might there be a scenario where someone wouldn't know that they're past visiting hours and 500 could be a little steep? I don't know.
We're the only one with visiting hours though, right?
Is it just you guys?
Yeah, I don't think anybody else has established visiting hours. So like for example, our area it's signed everywhere that there are visiting hours and then where it's closed and not closed and all these types of things.
Yeah, it is signed.
Okay. Let's say there's someone that's stargazing or something, you know. Is this too high of a penalty or, you know, that's, I guess, what you're bringing up.
Yeah.
Just like,
or maybe they got lost.
But
you know?
It comes down to the opposite.
Dark
right?
against
the
sign.
Oh, we need light
closed.
There's no thing saying that this has to be enforced, right? So for that example, right, for some reason, I'm at my natural area reserve after hours. Maybe a gecko set off the alarm, right? And I go down there, and there's some guys laying on the bench, like, looking at stars. I'm not going to call that cop, so I'm going to go for, you know what I mean? I'm going to tell them, hey, you guys got to go, or what are you doing? And maybe right there, if it's a bunch of FUs, then yeah, you might call the cops and get your ticket. But if not, it's probably one of those opportunities to just educate and move on, right?
Well,
let them know you could get a permit or anything.
I think with a lot of these kind of civil violations, too, there's a fair amount of officer discretion, right? Because, I mean, people get pulled over for speeding, but they don't get a ticket if it's not egregious and, you know, if depending on the circumstances.
Yeah, and I had another comment, too, though, when we were talking about the commercial and whether or not you think people will pay. To me, some of these, maybe the answer is to make the first offense really low, the second offense at the max kind of thing, right? Because that gives you the opportunities, like, yeah, you caught the guy that just popped up on island, didn't know, he got his one fine, he's not going to come back. But, you know, you got the other guys that are sneaking around us, they get caught one time, they pay the fine, they keep sneaking, and then you catch them for the 10,000 or something, right? And then that's substantial, that you know what I mean, that's a deterrent. You know, so that's another way to look at it. We've all been kind of just looking at the first category, but there's that tiers, right? So first could be low, middle, you know, the next two could be the max.
Question of clarification, because a lot of these companies, you know, they're companies and people are working for the company, right? And so is the fine to the owner of the company or the person who's leading the tour? And if it's a first and second offense, if they're two different people, is it, how does that
apply? Yeah, and if there's two different officers, I mean, I feel like we should just, you know, try to nip it in the bud initially.
I would assume that it is for the person that receives the money.
It's the operator. Because, for example, we had the coolie boat, and the guys on the boat were non-English speaking, like, you know what I mean? And the guy said, go get the fish from the airplane or something. then he gets the captain gets the fine for all the guys, right? The captain. He goes to the court.
Okay.
His company doesn't show up to back him up or anything. He would have had to take all that, but luckily the court was a little bit lenient on him because they recognized, like, oh, wow, you're going to take your commercial captain's license is going to take the cracks for all of these people and your supervisor telling you to do illegal activity, right?
Yeah.
Not to mention they assaulted her guy on the ground, all this other stuff, right? But, yeah, so it goes to the
owner.
Yeah,
okay.
To the
just,
dude
just
that's
to
there on site. Yeah, so if it's, like, a different operator the next day, then that's going to be a totally different, another first violation, in my opinion.
Before we keep going, I just want to see if there's any other technical clarification questions, because I want to be conscious of your time and let you go if you can go. So is there anything else we have for Catherine?
I was going to ask if any of these are, I don't necessarily see it, but if any of them are subject to multiple violations, you know, so where it's on a per count basis, but I couldn't quite see any of that in there, but I just wanted to clarify. For example, you know, if it's number of people over 10, you know, is it, you know, a different citation for every time that you violate, right? You've got 20, is that 2 tickets? If you've got 30, is it 3 tickets?
I think it would be each time here.
Well, I'm just wondering if there are any of these where, because certain, some civil things are, it is on a per count basis, right? You get a fine per instance.
Yeah,
and I'm
sure.
Wondering which of these, if any, apply
well,
that way.
You can do it by, like, say you have a group over 10 show up and they're all drunk. So you have 2 counts, but they were all drunk, you know, before too. So I don't know how you would do that if you had multiple.
I just don't know that
you multiply this number by this
number. Well, in a case of isn't it in a case of like OPEs? If you take OPEs
exactly
from that place,
yeah.
Each OPE is on different offense. So that's
right. That's what I'm just wondering if there are any of these that
apply
in that particular way.
Yeah.
It's
okay.
A really good question.
Yeah, I didn't see any of them were written where it could be interpreted that way. But
30 COA versus 1 COA branch.
Yeah.
Pretty big difference.
So there should be a multiplier somewhere in here for the number.
Yeah, well, it seems like most of these are just on a, you know, they're just incidental,
right,
you know,
yeah,
and that if you're. In terms of degree, then it goes, you know, the
yeah,
criminal round. If it's,
but again, that could be all officer's discretion, because that's most of the officers going to be issuing, the DOFAR officers are going to issue that ticket, so they're going to make that decision at that point when they see it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Catherine, if you want to stay, you can, but thank you for coming by and helping us with this.
Well, thank you, Catherine.
We still have some time to talk about it, but we'll just kind of focus on your thoughts on the amounts, which would be really helpful for us.
This is an interesting discussion.
I know. It's hard.
How are these numbers arrived at on this sheet? Did you guys have previous meeting and you hashed it all?
Like an auction block.
Yeah, it was.
Another.
We could use more help on it. Thank you.
Another thought with the commercial activity is, you know, in a lot of cases, you've got multiple vendors in some of these places. I mean, you know, multiple operators. And let's say one operator gets busted and the fine's low. And everybody hears that the fine is low, you know, without knowing necessarily that the second is higher. And, you know, that's just the word on the street. You know, they may continue to operate and say, oh, well, you know, I'll keep doing that. And even if the fine is low and they know that it's going to be higher, they'll say, well, just go anyway. The first fine doesn't count that much.
Oh, you did?
Yes. And that might incentivize people, you know, if it's low, to continue, you know, just to keep doing it. So it just seems like something that you want to get the word out, you know, even as an example. It's like, hey, these one guys got busted. Don't do it. Don't go down there.
Well, I'm hearing $2,500 for
the
first.
I feel.
But I do feel like commercial should be higher, definitely in general.
My heart is sinking because this is. We have tried to nail people on $2,500 violations, and
that's like the decade-long process that I'm talking about. So,
well, that's good,
putting it
out there. That's good
information.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Again, it's that
balance. Don't 2000 then.
Yeah. It's that balance thing.
Yeah.
How often are they with geek people, would you say?
Often. Yeah, commercial people, they're, I mean, I've got a database going where you can see, like, the same guy, same license plate on different days. I mean, they're, it's an everyday deal. If you've got a, you know, if you're booked, you're booked, you're going, right? So these guys, they're playing the numbers game, right? Because I'm not always there, and even when I am there, I'm not always going to see them, right? But, like, for example, I got an intern, and I had her down there for a month, like, watching that, right? And it was every day. She had five people recorded, you know, and the next day it was two of the same, you know? So it's really, I think it's egregious. The commercial activity in my area is nuts. Like, there is everything from people taking nude photographs for calendars and all that kind of stuff, all the way out to, like, tours. And,
yeah.
You know, I've seen a spearfishing tour even, right?
It is, there's not.
Well, what'd you say?
So I guess the reason I asked is I like your point about, I mean, basically these multiply by two
nice
each
calendar.
One.
Yeah.
Would it be better to make it go steeper? So rather than 50, 100, 200, you go 50, I don't know, 500, 5,000, something like that, so that the first offense is relatively low.
I think that's the balance we're looking for. Because I agree with Emma, you know, you don't want to go fight a contested case because you slap somebody at $2,500 right off the bat. But yeah, if you caught him twice, then give him the book.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, I went to. I would like to make a suggestion because I find listening to this group of people who are, this group is principally very committed professionals in science and people who are involved with active nonprofit or otherwise kind of things in favor of natural and cultural resource kind of people. I would love to, if Emma doesn't mind, maybe table it and we do a presentation on all of the review the contested case, all like the kind of questions and inquiry you're making, come up with an inventory of what it is, because natural resource and resource protection kind of things have been sort of poo-pooed for a long time. You know, people say, well, what the hell, it's just a damn flower or something. And nowadays we are finally moving the paradigm to where it means something. And in Hawaii we're shifting this significantly, I think, in terms of protecting the resource versus hustling the visitor bucks. And so my suggestion is if we do a more comprehensive presentation, not only with NARS, but with our natural resources, I'd love to get you folks' opinion and discussion extensively on just that subject, and then use that as a way of going forward with increased penalties and things at the legislature.
What subject again?
The whole thing on the whole issue of penalties as regards damage and abuse of natural cultural resources. Some cultural resource stuff has significant fines. Mm-hmm. You go in and you mess around with some EV and stuff like that, you can get pretty pounded on the head. But I think, you know, now it's, I just think it's a good time if you think it's worth making a statement. Even if they don't pass the law, we can get some legislators to consider introducing some changes. And we'd love to have you come and help testify, what have you. And shift the way we look at protection of our natural resources.
Does it take these law changes to put these
RVs?
Well, some can be done in rules.
Yeah.
But some significant shifts. Maybe.
I'd be in favor of that, especially because I was like shocked to not see anything on here about poaching, because it is such an issue in some places. Like, people are going to the forest and harvesting old growth koa and selling it, you know, on the black market. Like, that is happening.
Harvesting what?
It is illegal.
Oh. It
but
is,
I know,
yes.
But it's not listed as a thing like in here. It just says to remove, injure, or kill wildlife. Like, I mean, if there's a way to, like, you know, more focused.
You know, at one time in our history, we used to hang people who rustle cattle, who poach cattle. You know, the return on one cow versus the return on a koa tree is a huge difference. You make more profit on the koa tree.
It says any form of plant and animal life.
I guess I'm more like about the idea of, like, this could be just somebody going into the NAR and taking something for their personal, like, you know, like they want, or they're taking endangered. I'm talking about, like, people, like, going
right
on a regular
my
basis.
That would also be commercial activity.
Yeah.
Of a sort. But
it'd be hard to prove,
yeah,
though.
Yeah.
Illegal.
Illegal, yeah, but.
That would probably be subject to a higher fine.
Another.
You need to pass these four rules.
What we're trying to do is just implement this fee schedule so that we can actually enforce
right
with this process. And the numbers, I'm not saying they're irrelevant, but they can always change, right? I mean, moving forward, as far as the proposed fines, or is that...
They are going to change.
What we're trying to do is just get this in place.
She's looking for the support of this group to just get this bunch to the board for approval. Now, I would support that. And then go further if it's an item of interest in terms of looking seriously at making a shift in how we view this. I just happen to feel that now's a good time to send a message.
One, just because we are... You know, the NARs do have a very special designation within the state. Which of these are worth there being a higher penalty in the NAR as opposed to the forest reserves? I mean, without knowing what the, you know, if you're in a forest reserve or in some other area, you know, what the values are. There's a lot of good reason to have it be the same wherever you go, but certain things it seems like... The penalty should be higher for the NAR. So can you address that at all? Which of these are the same? Which are maybe different?
Well, the Forest Reserve folks haven't done their CRBS yet,
okay.
So we don't quite know what their draft is.
Okay.
So we can't compare. I mean, my take on it is there's some Forest Reserves that have just as good, if not better, native resources than NARs, so I'm kind of more of a streamlined government, make it standardized kind of person rather than necessarily differentiating. In fact, I would be more supportive of like having the same rules for NARs as Forest Reserves as wildlife sanctuaries, actually, because having all these separate rules is very confusing to us, not to mention the public. So that's kind of just my thoughts on it, but I welcome the other... NAR staff to kind of...
It just seems like it shouldn't be higher in the Forest Reserve than the NAR, so it seems like you wouldn't want to put this ahead of the Forest Reserves where you're lowering the fees in the NARs, but the same infraction in a Forest Reserve is 10 times as much.
I guess the other thing I would say is that some of these things only apply to the NAR, so they wouldn't even apply to the Forest Reserve, right? So it's illegal to do this in a NAR, but it's not illegal to do this in a Forest Reserve.
I think the only one is... Actually, the group larger than
10. So you can take...
So all the other rules apply to forest reserves as much as NARs?
Pretty much. I mean, there's like a few for just a Hickey Canal that wouldn't apply, and...
I thought that take ones, like you can pick up a rock in the forest reserve and put it in your pocket and walk out, right? Or is that
illegal?
We do that all the time.
You're supposed to get a permit even for, like,
you just said that on video.
Yeah, Bamboo, I knew that there was permits for
For example, in the Kula Forest Reserve, we have peaches growing, and like we go out there and get them and eat them. Is that illegal?
Yeah, technically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That'll be $2,500.
So
I always thought that the Forest Reserve rules were written around a little more use, whereas the NARS rules were written to eliminate any sort of take or damage. So in that essence, I think, to answer the question, in my opinion, is that any form of take in a natural area reserve should be rocketed higher than take in a forest reserve, right? Mm. And then damage and things like that, you know, I mean, you're in a multi-use area where people are using trails and things like that. You might damage things accidentally, but in a NAR, like, the standard is higher, I think.
I'm just wondering, in places where, like, for example, dogs, you know, the rules for dogs in a NAR versus a forest reserve. I'm just wondering, again, a lot of these are going to apply in both, but I mean, are there others, other situations that where we think things are going to be different?
I believe in certain forest reserves, you can have dogs if they're either caged or on a leash. And we've actually
with the exception of hunting dogs.
Yeah. We actually have been looking even at our own NARs to see whether we want to loosen up the rules to say, hey, it's okay to bring your dog in this NAR, as an example. So actually make our rules more consistent with...
under 5 pounds
or something.
Dogs under 5 pounds.
That's a rat.
Well, in the Maui forest, that's a rat. Because, like, the damage a few years ago that some of the dogs did at Kaena.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, that was...
Yeah, we would not let dogs in Kaena.
Absolutely not.
Yeah.
Warning, your dog will be shot, and your cat.
Yeah.
Yeah, but the question did come up for Maui NARs, and I mean, basically you have puyehs that are ground nesting birds out there.
Puyehs ground nesting?
Yes. So,
oh, yeah?
You know, that would be a hazard.
Oh.
Any that have water elements would have water birds.
I didn't even realize that.
Neither.
My favorite
bird. Like the lady who dropped off all the cat food at the end.
You always saw that.
What,
keep telling
her
about
her.
Give
her
a
ticket,
but she
maybe...
What's the deal with the environmental court? Environmental court.
Emma, can you answer this question?
About the environmental court? Is
which ones get deferred to the environmental court?
So that would be this, likely the either this criminal or civil penalty, so this wouldn't...
So
it would
be the criminal would go to the environmental?
I think maybe even the civil.
It's okay.
I'm not sure, but either I think could go.
Well, let's take a review of all that kind of stuff so that you have a...
Yeah. I agree.
Because it is a topic of interest, it seems.
Is what we're voting on today, or are we voting?
You're not voting.
We're not voting. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
But it wouldn't be bad to have a consensus expressed, maybe in support of the change forward.
Right. Basically, addition of...
I think we're going to do it, so I think that's...
Regardless of what we see.
But I think what you would really appreciate your help, and if you want to do this in later times and just email me or whatever, even as you review this, maybe on the plane ride home, you know, if you do have comments on the individual numbers and whether the categories are kind of in well-grouped, please just let us know, and we're going to be taking your comments to heart and... So, yeah, this is all just nothing to actually approve of, but we wanted to run this by you as the commission and get your thoughts on it as we develop it division-wide.
Okay. Like some of the questions that Michelle, I think, was saying, you could also consider, especially like posing questions to Emma or back to us, saying, what if? And that's one of the things that really helps.
And... definitely, if you feel like there are changes in the actual rules, like you look at this and you're like, ooh, that's not worded well, from time to time you do revise the NARS rules, and that'll go through you guys too. You'll actually have to approve it, but
well, you either recommend or don't recommend it, is the terminology. But that that's something that we can also take your feedback on, too.
Do you have a certain time you want our feedback by?
How about within a month?
Okay.
How's the signage stuff? Do we have signage, you know, NARS entrance and things,
some
access?
Some of them have signs.
Yeah. Is that something we might want to take an inventory of and look at and maybe redo? You know? People understand why we have NARS and why we consider it valuable and kind of begin an ethical kind of training, basic 101.
Like,
all idiots read this.
You should definitely check out Iñigo now because the signage there is really fabulous.
Oh, I know. Yeah, I've
and also kind of
done that many times.
Then.
Yeah.
So those are good examples.
But I'm just thinking, especially Big Island, we have places where, and I'm thinking Manu Ka, for example. Mm-hmm. Right? So there's a sign says you're entering Manu Ka Natural Area Reserve, right? But that's a very long stretch of road. And if you're a visitor and you happen not to notice that sign, you pull over on the side of the road, oh, there's a strawberry guava, let's eat it. It's like you could be in violation, right? Technically. So, but again, that's where the discretion would come in.
Really, I guess, balancing, and this is something we deal with a lot at Kaena, is we have this beautiful landscape. And so do we want to put a bunch of signs everywhere?
Right.
Or do we want to keep it open in wilderness? And so that, I guess, is the thought process. Plus, you know, they cost money, so that's...
Yeah.
In order to cite people, don't they have to be made aware of, like, the rules somehow?
Warning.
Ignorance
of the law.
There's a sign about, like...
yeah, and it's just such a long stretch of road.
Yeah.
Well, that's... Again, the difference of the burden of proof.
And when have you ever seen an enforcement guard in Manu Ka?
I mean, in general, you never see.
And then, do any of the rules address drones at all?
Yeah.
They fall. Okay. Is it here? Which? Okay.
You're standing in the NAR operating.
Okay.
But if you're standing outside of the NAR and you operated into the NAR, you're not illegal.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
And again,
operator are illegal. The drone in the air is not illegal.
That's why we pick up five of them a year.
Yeah, we pick them up.
They fly again, and then they're too chicken to go back.
Because then you bust them. Gotcha.
Yeah. You can sell them and put the money back into the nose.
That's it.
For that Manu Ka stretch, I mean, in Ahihi, we put these identity posts, and they were relatively cheap. It's an aluminum post with a gel laminate panel that says just a Ahihi Canal after. And we've got them every quarter mile along our road, so that's like probably the only way you can really, you know, you got, like we do, we have the rules right at the entrance, big ass sign, you're entering Ahihi Canal, and then every quarter mile there's another post that's reminding you that's like Ahihi Canal after. And their colors like the lava, so you don't, they're benign.
Yeah, this area is forested. I mean, it's, again, it's a matter of balancing, you know. And again, there is a point where if you're littering, you're littering. Like you're gonna get a fine. Like that's, you know. So
just give me a good idea. We gotta get our university guys have a little thing and invent a little rifle that can shoot the technological sound waves or whatever. They'll cut off the communication between the drone operator and the drone.
Oh, yeah.
Let it fall down in our property, and we will get it.
We've got some
jamming, you can jam.
A jamming kind of thing.
Yeah, like big.
Yeah.
Look like Star Wars kind.
Okay, so we've had some discussion of some of these points, but maybe we'll have an open comment period for the next month if there are additional things that people that may come to mind or that, you know, we may have in discussion with ordinary people maybe who don't, you know, think about this stuff but may think, oh wow, $100 fine. that?
Yeah, sounds good.
You agree with that? Okay, and we don't have any decision item on this at the moment, so we can probably go ahead and move on to the next item, which is the restricted access to Lihau.
Do we have any pictures? Do you have pictures of the maps and that? Did you get that to them?
Probably
still
on here.
Yeah.
Okay,
just put those up.
So Lihau Nar is on the West Maui Mountains. Onakahala Bay, it's on the lee side. Its dry forest has a lot of endangered plant species, plant extinction prevention species, so those are less than 50 in that. And it has remarkable geology. Well, we also found on vertical walls that it has become a commercial wall climbing location.
Meaning dikes? Or
meaning putting steps in and climbing holds up essentially vertical walls. And it's probably commercial, not for certain, but Maui, Climb Maui, and also climb organizations here on Oahu, taking people over there, meeting people over there. And so we were annoyed by that, especially because some of the, that's the location I'm showing you too.
Just putting it out there, does anyone see a jump drive that's silver? Because that actually has, that would help me with the maps. Is that in anyone's? No. Okay, well.
There's a jump drive right there.
No, this is very sad. Well, we'll go with this for now.
So anyways, these two dots show the location of where we have steps. We've looked at them from the air. They go up many hundreds of feet. The gulch below them is so narrow that we've had the helicopters that do the rescue say that even with a 600-foot lead, we could never get a body or an injured person out of the gulch below these. So that's where they're at and where they're doing it. The concern we have is some of it goes over, some of the steps, bottom two steps of one of them goes right over a plant species for which there's only six left. Right under the steps. So there hasn't really been damage, but We do want to prevent people from going in there, and we are going to try and find a contractor, figure out a way of removing them without causing a fire. It's a very dry area, and if you had sparks from saws trying to saw the steps off, we're not sure how we'll deal with it. So one of the immediate things that we thought we could possibly do is ask for a closure to make it illegal to go up these walls. I looked at the Fish and Wildlife Service's dry cliff critical habitat designation, but in a way that doesn't do it justice because it says things that are 65 degrees slope or greater. These are literally almost as straight up and down as the wall that I'm facing behind you, that we don't want these people to go in and do. To access it, they walk through a very isolated gulch where there is the only known West Maui high viscous bracken ridgeye population. So that might just get trashed by going through it is another problem. And so we have safety concerns. We have vertical walls with materials in it. It's illegal to leave anything in a NAR to deface geological features, which these walls are. And so we're going to ask for closure of the walls. We'll put signs down where they access it, telling that climbing is no longer legal there. And the other reason we have to deal with this, I'll bring up as last, we had people who were doing the climbing yell at researchers who had permits to be there doing work with Shedia, and said that, you know, get out of here, we will kill you and drop you with the other bodies. So the researcher actually filed
Jesus.
A formal complaint, feeling fear for their life. They sort of got off the track of where they were going and waited until the people in the climbing walls were gone. So it was a safety concern. We don't know if that was an isolated incident or if it's a territorial thing, or if they thought that, what they thought, we don't know. We had people formally lodge a threat to the police and to Scott Fletz, the district manager, and myself about the activities in there. So something needs to be done. We are thinking of closure, but it's not closed. I don't want to close the NAR. Access is allowed. I'd like to close the feature. And the way we have this written up in your presentation is probably the closest we've gotten to it. While it does say greater than 65 degrees, it's really climbing walls. And the reason we wanted it categorically closed is so that they say, oh, well, we can't do it on these three locations. We'll just move to the next locations for doing this. And so that's sort of the predicament.
So are these carabiners that they've put in, or
that are epoxied into place?
Epoxied.
Drilled and epoxied into place.
That's not.
And it's only recently discovered, or?
It was discovered about a year ago, yes, by people going in to do PEP species for Hank Oppenheimer.
And how will you close the walls?
We have a map, basically, that identifies where we believe the walls exist. And so that's what the area.
Wish we had that photo of it.
Kind of in this hatched is these cliffs. And so we actually do not include the stream bottom itself. So basically, if you're actually on the wall, then you're in violation, but someone just walking and accessing the NAR on the stream would not be in violation.
So I foresee making signs that are posted saying this wall is closed. And we've gone to Joe here and the Conservation Resource and Enforcement Officers, and they say too that, then if they're past the sign at the wall, they could be prosecuted.
So now these are pitons that are epoxied into walls in the NAR.
In the NAR, yes. In the NAR wall. I'm growing up hundreds of feet.
So it seems like the kind of individuals we're maybe dealing with here were, already, I mean, because there is signage saying you're entering the NAR.
I would say in Lehigh, that's not the case.
There's no...
It's really pretty real.
Okay. So I'm just wondering the degree to which they're acting. I mean, I guess there must be some sense that they're doing something.
Well, they have
a little
to,
bit.
Yeah, they have to cross. They have to trespass on private land to get to the NAR, and then they're in the NAR.
Okay.
But you, excuse me, you know which path people take to get there. Is that correct?
Yes, you have to be an animal to get there. But yes, we do know. They're very difficult over very large boulders in the gulch, and it's not easy access. But there's one, we know the way that they are going in, yes.
Do you know who these people are?
Well, I was contacted by one guy who wants to come meet with me, the time has elapsed where he said he would get back to me when his partner is here. And we haven't heard anything more from them.
When I was working up at the Water Commission, we had people out at Lyonai, they a climbing group, and they wanted, there was a dike there, and they wanted to put up pitons and everything else, and I think we let them. But I don't know if that's the same group that's now expanded to Maui to do
Well, you can go online, find Climb Mali.
Okay.
They do not specify where they're climbing, but, yeah. And there are other areas in Forest Reserve where there's climbing walls and some coastal areas, too. But this offers sort of an inland thing. It's not as crumbly, perhaps, as some of the coastal climbing areas.
Yeah.
And,
Is Climb Mali a tour company? Or is it just a group of friends, or what is
we
it?
Think that it may be Climb Mali, and I forget what the
commercial
primary
activity.
Climb thing.
Generally, for visitors coming to climb, it's going to be a guided tour. They'll use
there's a certain entomologist that has a climb company that is a federal employee, and I think he may also be involved with the knowledge of these, of implementing. So we're hoping to contact those people to find out if they can assist in removal.
Yeah, because for visitors, generally, it would take too long to go and do it yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, doing the recon, finding the place, setting up. You're wasting time.
Well, I do think they're commercial. I think that they're contacting Climb Mali
yeah.
or whatever other climb organization.
We should at least get a cut.
has somebody contacted this Climb Mali or whoever these people are and just told them this act, whoever put these in did it illegally, don't use these, you know, just told them?
Well, the person I talked to, yes, he knows that. He said it isn't us, the ones who climb there, so us means more than one. It isn't us, and we would not make threats like that. So I don't know how many people use the area. The next step that we would have, if you agree with the closure, is that we will have signage going in on the trail that we know. We would have some sort of a opportunity. I will call back this guy's number, and if I get anyone, let them know that, yes, we would like to meet with you, and we'd like to meet with people who you know who do this, and explain the circumstance.
Fern, I must have missed something. Did I hear you say threats?
Yes.
From who and to whom?
There were threats to researchers doing permitted work in there by people on the climbing walls.
To our staff also?
No, no staff was present at that time, just the researchers.
I was going to say, if you do put up signs or give justification for this, don't specify which plants you're talking about, because there's only six individuals they
yes.
could go, and I'm sure you probably thought about that, but they could just remove it.
These kind of people will do something
yeah.
just out
well,
of spite.
Because they're right there on the step, and a misstep, like sliding off of it,
yeah.
you might already take out a
yeah.
sizable portion of the plant.
Why wasn't a sign put up a year ago when this was discovered that said these are illegally installed climbing routes, you will be cited if you use them or something
it's
like
that.
It's
not illegal.
It's not illegal. You can go to a NAR and you can hike. Climbing in a NAR is not
but pounding those little
but defacing a geological feature is.
But using a defaced geological feature is not. So
right.
if we had caught someone in the act, yeah, we could have that is illegal, but now that people are just using them, that's...
But it's not illegal to climb in an R.
If you don't want to encourage, just cut them off.
So that's what I was also going to ask. If people have been climbing without ever putting those tools in...
Oh, it's still stepping up the climb.
Well, sure. Yeah, okay, so that makes it tricky. The actual climbing is not the illegal part. It's whoever put in those... facilities.
And we've had it looked at by people who have repelling experience, things like this, and they're saying it's very tricky to try and envision taking them out such a dry area. So if you tried to grind them out, you could have sparks. You don't want to light a fire below you.
Yeah.
And so you'd have to get there to the top and go down, or the bottom and go up, but then you end up on a very narrow ridge. Maybe I can show you with this. Where did the cursor go? So it's this entire slope, but when you get up to the top of it, it's probably only 3 feet wide. So, but they have left climbing materials on the top in bags, and at the bottom of the climbs in bags. So it's obvious that people go there often enough to do this climbing.
I take it that the materials have been confiscated?
No, not yet.
I don't want to put
so it's the idea of staking it out,
I guess, it seems like effectively what the closure does then is it makes it illegal to climb or to use these things that have been put in effectively,
right,
but without closing the NAR outright.
Without closing it, without closing off that activity, Dokair seemed to not see that there was much of a vehicle to do much.
What about installing a motion-sensitive camera? I know you guys use those.
Into and try to identify persons.
Yeah, right.
But as Peter can attest from Ahihi Kinau, you basically have to have a license plate of the person getting in or out of that vehicle and then showing up somewhere else.
Well, the terroristic threatening is definitely illegal.
Yeah. But I think just thinking about the situation where somebody going in now, after the fact, it may not be the people who made the threats. It may not be the people who put the holds in place. And so if they weren't the people who did any of those things and they're not in violation of any existing rule, effectively there's nothing to stop them from continuing to do it. And
that's
so
correct.
It seems like this rule effectively does that.
That's what
the closure does.
So it's like a temporary closure or permanent?
Well, it's 2 years.
Oh.
We can only ever ask for 2 years
at
a time.
Oh, yeah, that's great. Do we have to specify?
Which will allow us to deal with contracting to get them taken out by somebody who's brave enough to
do that. When you do that, could you take out just like the bottom third? If it really is going to risk a fire to take the whole thing out, if you make most of it just inaccessible.
Yeah, we'd have to assess, but we haven't gotten far along on how we're going to do that.
And the bottom third is where the vegetation that would light on fire would
that's
have
right.
to be.
Right.
So,
and the irony is you need them to probably traverse that just to even get
that, yeah,
to
that's,
the other ones.
So it is unique. It's not asking for closing a NAR. It's asking for closing a certain segment.
And it's a segment that's only accessible by doing this damaging or contributing to or benefiting from this damaging activity.
Maybe Glenn knows a definition for that sort of a cliff.
It would be it looks like a dike, I would say.
Yeah.
Large dikes. There are large dikes up in that area.
Ukumehame
has
a really
huge one.
Famous one.
Yeah.
Right, and there are climbing walls like this in Ukumehame. So if they're not there in Lihau, they're in Ukumehame in the forest reserve.
Well, what's the vertical distance that we're talking about?
A few hundred feet. Right? About 200, 300 feet.
One length of rope.
No.
So it's all the basaltic face that they're using.
Yeah.
If they're epoxying something, that's the only material I think we have, right?
Right.
For them.
Well, I don't know. It could be some other rock type up in there, but it's...
There's some trachytes.
The trachytes are really dense and able to...
I guess I'm thinking if we do this, we should make it somehow obvious why this has happened to prevent a repeat.
Right.
Like, would it be something you want to do a press release with it?
That's kind of what I'm thinking. Yeah, because when Ahihi Kinau gets closed again, it's a big deal because lots of people go there.
Right.
Whereas in this case, it's probably only these climbers go here other than permittees, right? Or maybe there's hunting in there, I don't know.
No.
Let the commercial organizations or companies just make sure they are being informed.
Yeah, exactly.
That the state is preparing to disengage all of the material that were used and is putting into place rules and statutes that will criminalize this vandalism.
It's kind of commercial activity.
Right, it is, I'm sure, commercial activity.
Yeah.
Well, that's why you inform them.
Yeah.
You don't have to go inform the rest of the world.
Maybe more than 10 people.
And there would part of this would include signage saying that it's closed.
Yes, signage, so of course.
It seems,
And outreach. We would have to do outreach to them so that they didn't get there only to find out that this is happening.
Yeah.
Although we would like to get pictures of them first.
Yeah, the problem is I think it would be very difficult to prove who put those in.
Right, especially if they're walking far. Like, they're only limited places to park, and it's a good hike after that.
You have to get start with this guy. They're claiming Dave Elberg is their hero, and he's the one on the rope on the wall. Maybe he's the guy that put it on there.
What?
Do we
Social
know?
Media Climbers Association of Maui.
Do we know if the researchers could recognize the people that were terrorizing them?
Good question. I don't know that. But we can find out.
Yeah. Is show them the picture.
There is a formal police report, so I don't know what sort of information the police took on it.
Okay, so effectively the recommendation then would be, if approved, would be essentially to approve of the closure of just those cliff areas as defined by
the map,
for two years, and it's a closure of a limited part of the NAR.
I had trouble designating it. I don't know if the way it has been put into writing right now is sufficient, in your opinion, or in the commission's opinion, for what we want to do. That's why I'd like to emphasize that it's really pretty much the vertical walls that are in there.
Yeah. And there would be signage, there would be every warning available to somebody who wanted to violate that. So it seems straightforward. It's not going to affect other people. A permittee, hypothetically, who needed to access a rare plant could get a permit.
Because there's a
letter
already.
Restricted area. Well, I'm just thinking of who else is affected, and it just seems like it's very minimal.
Let's see. Is it the wall?
I just looked that up real fast on Climbers Association of Maui, but I think it's funny that they're congratulating that guy. Like, maybe he went and put some more bullets up there.
Jesus. Okay, so I think we're clear on what the recommendation is. Do we have a motion to recommend
what
closure?
What kind of rock is that? Could be track.
We have a motion and a second. Any further discussion or public testimony regarding this issue?
I guess, he keeps saying vertical walls. I'm guessing they're not truly vertical.
Take a look.
Well, yeah, no, they're vertical.
But I'm sure there are some slopes that are not quite vertical that you also don't want people on. And if you just said all slopes greater than 65 degrees or something, that would be a little bit more.
That's less
the area that's shown there.
I think they should just close it after an elevation.
It does say 65 here.
Rock climbing is a prohibited activity in this NAR. Period.
Or in all NARs. Can you say that?
We can't change the rules right now. We have to use an existing rule. So we can't just make rock climbing prohibited. We can decide to change the rules in the future, but for this particular one, we can just use the access restriction rule and map out where we want people to not be.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So it's effectively it's effectively doing that in all but name.
Yeah.
Okay. So we have a motion.
Vertical walls
on the
noise.
Table. Any other further comments, questions? Okay. All in favor of recommending this partial restricted access, say aye.
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 Aye. All opposed?
And why you didn't put in those?
Any abstentions?
Thank you.
Okay. Motion carries.
So Emma, this goes to the board, so are there further steps that I need to be aware of what we have to do to take it to the board?
Let's go to the board.
In your presentation, I would recommend that you show some of these kind of pictures and stuff, so people have an idea and why it's what natural resource is being harmed or potentially destroyed.
Yeah, I mean, I think, and when you start doing public outreach, photographs of these structures and how they've damaged the rocks, I think will make it much more useful for the public to understand why this is important.
I think the rare plant protection angle is also very important.
Do we have any climbers? Do we know any climbers? Somebody just got to infiltrate the group, because if you read...
I know people who know people.
Yeah, they're like, oh, just call Artie.
Jeffrey, I've put on a harness before. I don't know. I don't like it.
Okay, let's go ahead and move along. Item 7, updates, Native Ecosystem Protection and Management Section Personnel, State Legislative Session, and discuss scheduling and items for future commission meetings.
I'll make a little presentation, and then I'll open it up for Nick and Fern and Peter to also talk about what's going on in their islands.
I gotta leave.
Oh, please, go for it.
Soon. Can I just do mine real quick?
Yes, go for it.
All right. I'm Nick Agarasis. I'm the Natural Areas Program Manager, Hawaii Branch. I'm going to lead off of this, so I didn't print anything out. I'm going to first start off. 10 years ago, I stood and briefed the commission and provided a program update. At that time, we had 4 civil service staff, 3 RCH PCSU staff. Today, we are 22. What's been going on currently is we've been filling various civil service positions. 6 of 11 civil service positions are filled. Remainder are out for recruitment. RCH and PCSU staff is currently at 16 with 2 vacancies and 1 student hire. This includes the successful transition of the PET program and its 2 employees. We're in between interns at this part of the season. We had 3 this past year and are looking for 2 this coming season. This is an integral part to our program. So as I indicated earlier, we have 22, and at full build-up, we are 30. So we've come a long way. Some of the real quick updates of what we're actually doing currently. We have completed the Upper Ola'a unit in Pumakaala Natural Area Reserve. That's 1,900 acres. And we are currently working on the Army Road Unit, which is an additional 1,100 acres. Ungulate removal has been initiated and is ongoing, with a total of roughly 3,000 acres slated for a complete removal of ungulates by the end of 2020. We have an additional 4 CIP fencing and ungulate removal projects in the hopper that, when completed, will protect an additional 5,700 acres in 4 natural air reserves. Estimated completion date is 2025 for ungulate-free status. In the recently fenced 25,500-acre Manukau Natural Area Reserve, all 3 species of feral ungulates, pigs, goats, and sheep, are actively being engaged. While the time frame for ungulate-free status is unknown at this time, it is important to note that the engagement of feral ungulates on this large landscape is significant in and of itself. Lastly, the only known population of Partialina physa within the NAR system is being actively managed by the SEP program. 10 individuals brought into captivity in the past year to start a managed breeding population, now number 20 in less than a year. That's my update for this week. So, questions? Thank you.
Just a minor addition, we also have the Alala release effort, which has been going quite well. I mean, I don't know if you have any comment about that, but...
It is going well. It's recently had a few rocky bumps in the road. We lost one bird to... Literally lost it. Don't know where it is. Haven't been able to find it. And then one succumbed to predation by an EO. That said, those kinds of things were expected. When they were going to surface is unknown, but I would generally say that that project is still very successful and they're learning quite a bit. They will be slowly transitioning. They still have a permit to release 6 additional birds. 3 were just released last week. I couldn't speak to the status of them, other than there have been no red flag events, so there's
done that, but as I indicated, they will be transitioning to TNC's Conahama Preserve 2021, 2022, something like that, for the next phase of that project. Yes, sir.
Sounds like with the growth of NARS and the protection of these wonderful places and the extension of the growth of the staff, you may need some more space.
Space is always very limiting, and it definitely hinders our capacity. Those are some of the things that we're working on with you and with Emma, and we'll be going to the legislature this year. We have staff. We're piled on top of each other. We're not always storing our materials in areas that are secure or in areas that we could keep them, so we're not having to double efforts on biosecurity, things like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're kind of at a point where our capacity, I don't see us getting much bigger without some infusions into infrastructure.
I just wanted you to mention your need for space to the commission so they can get you can get their support. So as we move forward.
Thank you, appreciate that, Bob.
Yeah.
A long time ago, you were fighting Koki frogs in Manuka.
Yes.
Was that successful?
No, from the aspect of that we were not able to rid Manuka Koki. We learned some really interesting skill sets doing that. Learned a lot about Koki, but no, ultimately we were not successful.
Yeah, what I wanted him to also point out is that we're looking at using the Waimea Nursery site as an extension and development of the Hawaii County, Hawaii Island District NARS headquarters, because then it'll centralize and expand to a lot of the places that need their attention, which David and I, by the way, he's my cohort in conniving this. I mean planning.
I'm just curious, what was the status on Kahala? Did that open up again?
Kahala is open.
Oh.
I'm sorry, I did not. Something's kind of slipped my mind.
So
Kahala, we quietly let just the closure expire. We've done a lot of efforts in the past year preparing for that. Basically, ever since the Lower East Rift eruption stopped and everything ceased, I'm in fairly regular contact with HVO, the Hawaii Volcano Observatory staff over there. And I want to say about 3 or 4 months ago, they downgraded basically the entire volcanic area. And that was more of a confirmation for us to go ahead and move forward and just make preparations to allow it to quietly expire without any fanfare. That said, we've done a bunch of signage. A lot of that was due to a resource violation that we battled right here in this room. But as well as trying to be proactive, marking our boundary, did some trail clearing and also some maintenance. And then added some more safety signage, those kinds of things. So yes, it is back open, but yeah, without a lot of fanfare. We are planning to do a limited press release. Well, I'm not entirely sure on the terminology there on the Nalahele website. So, but we wanted to just ease back into it and not have a whole bunch of people showing up on day one.
With CLP monies in various locations. Actually, probably like the most, it's the strategy to continue to fence, to remove ungulates, and perhaps eventually to get away from having to do constant aerial shooting that we do times a year over there, and we remove hundreds of pigs each time we do it. And so strategic fences have been planted by Hope Colony, in fact, that they were up there this past week, and then other areas that are over closer to the national park at Kalaupapa. So eventually, I'm not sure what the total time frame would be, but probably the next 5 years, I hope, we close off all of the remaining areas so that we have prevented pig ingress into the area, and then we'll have to have big discussions of management with the National Park and with other with TNC for pig removals once the fences are complete, so that that areas can be addressed. On Maui, we have CIP funding to do fencing for the lower portion, the unfenced portion of the Kanaio Natural Area Reserve, and on the portion below the road, sort of like a triangle, if you're familiar with the way it appears on a map. And we want to incorporate that with fencing, perhaps down to take in the appropriate lava flows that are on Uwapalakua Ranch and on our boundary. And we've yet to actually get the ranch to meet with us to find out the exact route they'll be agreeable to. But it's all tied into this larger forestry management area that will be for game production, and then small fences for the rare plant species that are down there, and the coastal area that we brought up earlier with the Ahihi Canal addition. So we have yet to fence Ahihi Canal, but once we fence the Kanaio lower portion, then we have basically all of the NARs fenced except for the lower boundary of Honolulu, which is not very good fencing. I mean, not very good native habitat, but very important as a buffer, especially as we move forward. Big concerns for Nepom on Maui, the island of Maui, is really how this is going to work out with the water leases. Currently, Alexander Baldwin, Innovation, they've had a lease to completely lease the entire NAR, although no water is taken out of the NAR, but just below the NAR. And we are talking about changes that we'd like to see in permits, the local permits going forward, to specify that it's not appropriate to have the entire NAR under a lease circumstance to install irrigation. And I've heard that that's actually moving forward. So that will be a big change. We currently have newly constructed offices at the Bayshard. Program got new offices. We're completely filled up already. So because I have PEP and the Plant Extinction Prevention Program and the Snail Extinction Prevention Program. And so we basically have to start putting people back into trailers that we've taken them out of because of space concerns. So we are looking down the road at a much bigger phase of construction at the base yard where we're at now. But I just figured talking with the consultants that we would need to add just for space that would be required by the unions, 1,650 more square feet of office space for what we figure we will be at with the regular hiring of staff that we've been doing over the past 5 years and carrying it forward for the next 5 years. So that's that would sort of double. It'd be sort of like kicking everybody else out of their offices and taking them over for the NEPM program. So we'll really have to see how this all shakes out in the future. Snails were brought up for the Big Island. Kiahi Bustamente is the snail person, Molly, under NEPA, and he has found or rediscovered at least six species on West Maui that were not known to science or not currently known in the last year, and several on Molokai and in Olokui, one of the natural area reserves. We found very good populations still existing of certain partialinas and other species that are very rare. Almost all of those species have had a portion taken into captivity over here on this island. They're arranging to get snail refrigerators and snail captivating things eventually over on Maui so that there isn't a back and forth. The district manager and other people have sort of objected to the idea that Maui resources would be going to Oahu for storage versus being handled on Maui, plus just duplication of facilities. So that would be something down the road to look at. We have the mid-elevation nursery for the Plant Extinction Prevention Program, and the Plant Extinction Prevention Program in Oppenheimer working under us, and that's also something that needs to expand. We have so many endangered species on Maui, and 113 PEP species on Maui. I think there are about 50 on Molokai. I'm not sure. Maybe you know, Michelle. But anyways, a whole lot of very rare plant species that need attention. And so the other thing that Maui NEPM has been doing is we're in a planning process with diverse set of fish and wildlife and other agency USGS specialists, Lucas Fortini, and climate change considerations for planning how to restore these species, snails, birds, and plants on state lands. And a lot of that will be on NARS. What else? And Lahihi, we're going to have the experiment of public people paying for parking and seeing how that can be fed back into better management of that NAR and staffing it to address the influx of people that are there each day, like 2,000 people. It's a really an amazing task, and thanks to Peter, he does a really good job of managing it. Any questions?
Did you say part of Hanavi is being leased? I didn't quite get that.
All of Hanavi is being leased in these very old water permits that have been getting fed, redone recently as revocable permits, and where we're waiting for an EIS, which we heard about will take 10 years. There's another revocable permit being discussed right now with EMI and with Mahi Pono, because they just bought interest into that. But they actually leased all of the NAR, which was news to me when I took this job. And it's there's actually, I don't think, a justification for it. So I'm hoping in this current permit and certainly into the future that that not be there. All the water is being produced. You saw the map before. There's lots of water being produced in the NAR, but all the collection is just Makai of the NAR boundary.
Yeah, I guess I wanted to just add, from a statewide level, we went through the last state legislative process. There wasn't all that much change in our general fund allocations. They stayed pretty steady. And while we do ask for more positions, that wasn't received. The thing that we were able to get help from the legislature was a watershed CIP allocation for fiscal year 20 and 21, which totaled around $6 million a year per year. And so those are the projects that are tentatively what we're looking at for funding. They might change a little bit. There's still some tweaks that we're doing. It's a lump sum CIP, so it's just for watershed protection statewide, so we do have the flexibility to move some of these projects around and budgets, which is really helpful. But this is one of our major goals for the Native Ecosystem Program, and it reaches our 30 by 30 goal to protect 30% of our watershed forests by 2030. So it'll allow us to remain on track to reach that goal, and knowing that we'll probably need another $5 million a year in the future to remain on that track. I guess as far as personnel, we, I think, are pretty also steady at the administrative office. We didn't have many changes this past year statewide with our personnel. We're just kind of slowly gathering more and hiring more civil service after kind of a huge loss of a lot of staff in the 2015-2016 times. Lots of retirements. Just seemed like everyone left at that point. So now we're kind of rehiring. So that's good. Well, I think one thing that we will send out to you folks is our legislative report of the actual accomplishments that we are having over the years. So you can kind of see, you know, how many invasive plants, acres of invasive plant control we've been doing, how much plantings we've been doing, where we're protecting areas from hoofed animals. And I had given this presentation earlier this morning to the joint consultation meeting, but our total footprint of what we are managing as far as ungulate, the goal is ungulate-free, not all the units are at that point yet, is about 100,000 acres with the Native Ecosystem Program, which includes a lot of the watershed partnerships, natural area partnerships, as well as our DOFA programs. Then we're also doing a lot of Youth Conservation Corps projects, tree planting, and enormous emphasis on weed control. And I think that's something that we can see the trajectory as a lot of these areas are fenced and ungulates removed, similar to Waikamoy. We're now moving into focusing more on the weeds and dealing with that. So hopefully increasing amounts of management for these areas. One thing that has really come up recently, and it was actually a paper that published this just a few weeks ago, was the significant difference between a fenced area and an unfenced area with rapid ohia death, with statistically, you know, significantly fewer dead or dying ohia trees mapped in those areas. And so it really provides another sense of urgency to remove ungulates in some of these areas, especially ones that are vulnerable to rapid ohia death. And we actually have gotten the United States Geological Survey to put our fenced areas that are being proposed on a map to show how vulnerable they are to rot, which largely is just how many ohia trees exist in these areas, as well as where rot seems to be most prevalent, to allow us to reprioritize based on what most urgently needs to be fenced and protected from rapid ohia death. It doesn't prevent rapid ohia death, of course, but it significantly reduces the amount of dead trees that we're seeing.
Other updates? We don't have anyone from Kauai or Oahu.
No, we do not have.
Let's see. So, section personnel, state legislative session.
That was mostly, you know, kind of the stable operational funding, and then the big gains were the watershed CIP.
Will you be sending out, like, a detailed sort of line item, what got funded eventually?
useful thing is our legislative reports, which we can send out. And as far as the watershed CIP list, I'd be happy to give that to you too. And it's the problem is, we're still tinkering with this list, and it might change even as we start implementing things. You know, some things might fall off, some things might go forward. For instance, I think that we're going to probably drop Lumahai, for instance, and as one example, and maybe add a Ka'u unit or something. So there's going to be some trade-offs, and so it's kind of a fluid thing. But this is kind of what we currently, have provided to the legislature. But yeah, I can shoot that over to you for sure.
Yeah, that'd be great.
And with all of these, we're really interested in your comments on this. I mean, if there's an area where it just doesn't make sense because you think it's too weedy, or if you think there'd be much better use of our funding some other place, you're the experts in a lot of these cases, so we'd love your thoughts on it. And also, you can add value to, why we need to protect these areas if you know of rare species locations or some geological, benefits for these places or whatever, this is a way that you can help us out. Thank you.
Updates. I guess the last order of business is just future meetings and agenda items.
Well, currently our default is if we have something that needs your attention, we'll schedule a meeting. So if there's anything in particular that you want us to focus on in a meeting and call a meeting, you can always instigate that yourself too and let me know. But in the absence of that, we'll just go with whenever we have something.
I have a question. The TMT, is that going to be in the footprint of NARS, Mauna NARS? Not at all. It's how far out of is it? I'm not familiar with the boundaries of the NARS up there, but is
The Natural Air Reserve is basically,
the distance
if you're looking at the mountain, it's like from the 5 o'clock to the 7 o'clock.
Okay.
And the TMT is more on the northern, like 1 o'clock.
Okay.
Yeah.
One of the staging areas is something. I mean, for materials, which is roadside, but it's relatively close to the NARS boundary, is my understanding. Mm-hmm. And that's at the apex of the NARS, so right at the center of the clock. But it's not technically on the NARS.
I think there might be potential for us to do site visits to seminars in the future, because I think that helps us to better understand what the needs are of the NARS, the different NARS.
Yeah, just tell us where you want to go. And in some cases, it makes sense if you would just want to go and we can take you versus having a whole commission meeting. It's a whole additional administrative process to set up a commission meeting and fly everyone over. So it's kind of like, what are you interested in? So, but we're happy to show you folks around.
If you represent an island area, you should make that your first priority to visit every NARS on your island.
Well, that's easy for me.
Yeah, I've been there. Up and down.
She's from Hawaii.
No, Kauai.
Oh, Kauai.
Yeah.
No,
no.
No,
there's two.
There's two.
Two.
Oh, two.
But I'd love it if you guys wanted to come over and see some of the issues that we're dealing with.
Mm. We were back when we went in on it, so I was going to get into the doors.
Okay. Any other items or recommendations or comments or questions or musings?
The QEQ or Parrotville translocation efforts are proceeding. People are all doing repairs to fences and trails clearing trails for the two locations within the Honolulu where the birds will be getting captured in October. The first capture will be early October and begin the 9th of October. And it'll be 9 days, 9 consecutive days where they'll be up there doing that. And then they'll be transferred to Nakulinar, where the cages, release cages, are already in place and the infrastructure
oh,
and
have,
people
oh,
is
I'm planning.
Pretty much in place
oh,
up there.
This is good.
So there's going to be quite a bit of publicity, there was currently, of the condition of the care building and the Kohekohe, and there's a communication plan for QEQ. You're going to see repeated published information in the next coming weeks. Throughout Maui, there will be all sorts of talks by the Maui Forest for Recovery Project staff and others as to the actual mechanics of it. And if you have special expertise and can be up there for greater than a week at a time, there might be even an opportunity to get you up there to be part of the work needed on the ground.
I'm not covering the grass, Pat.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll go ahead and adjourn.